It is January 30th, 2010, 10:06 a.m. on the Central Coast of California. Hey, today is Al Luckow's one-year anniversary on GeekSpeak.
The bandwidth for GeekSpeak.org is provided by GNI, GNIHosting.com.
And of course, it's time now, right here on KOSP, for GeekSpeak. Welcome to GeekSpeak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during GeekSpeak are not necessarily those of KOSP. Welcome to GeekSpeak. My name is Lyle Troxell, and in the air room with me, I have Mr. Miles Elam. Morning, Miles.
Good morning.
And Miles, a slacker and political junkie, is also available for web development training and teaching and some development, correct?
Mm-hmm.
All right. We also have Al Luckow, the man of the hour. Al Luckow used to be a fire dancer. He's now a new media architect. How do those two career paths merge, Al?
I didn't think you'd mention that.
What were you talking about?
I tried to anticipate, you know.
I thought I mentioned it last night.
I don't know what to say. Yeah.
Well, anyway, it's been a year you being on the show. Yep. Thank you so much for being here. It's been a pleasure. We've had wonderful additions to the show. For quite a while, we had this wonderful theme of bringing up robots every week. And still, to this day, when I think of a robot story, I think of you.
Wow, well, it's been a year. Yeah. It feels so much longer.
Yeah.
Oh, no. I'm just kidding.
We still get people emailing in robot stories.
Some people love them, some people hate them.
And, you know, I mean, bring them up. I'll, you know, come back at you and out of nowhere, there'll be a string of robot stories.
Do we have any robot stories today?
There was, actually, I didn't put one in because it didn't.
Yes,
it didn't.
I have a robot story.
Okay.
Well, fine.
Miles?
Spirit, one of the Mars rovers. NASA's giving up on it. It is dead.
I saw a great comment. Did you see the comment?
Robot dead.
Did you send the comic to me about this?
Oh, no, I didn't, but I know which one you're talking about.
I hate describing comics on air, but it's basically this little robot that can do it. He can just keep going, and he keeps going. He tries to do better, and finally he's just left
in the dust. The one I saw was saying, okay, one day down, 89 to go.
Yes.
The original mission was only supposed to be 90 days. Right. And he goes, okay, 88 days down, 2 to go. And then I'll get to go home.
Right. This whole thing the robot wants to come
home. And then a year goes, well, maybe if I do a really good job, they'll let me come home now. I'll work harder.
So are both of them down or just Spirit?
Just Spirit.
Well, I do have, I mean, there is a robot story. I mean,
well, I guess if you, we've tickled your
this,
robot.
This bone. Actually isn't quite as, this one, it's January 25th, 1979. This is a similar, it's very, it's almost like an anniversary. Is the first instance of a robot killing a human.
Was it a manufacturing?
Yeah, it was a Ford Motor Assembly line worker, and it was in Flat Rock, Michigan, and it was the first recorded human death by a robot.
And this is one of those robotic arms that puts together cars?
Yep, and it just swung around and
he happened to be in the wrong spot.
He was in the wrong place at the wrong time. And
did he provoke it?
Yeah, I don't know.
Was he teasing it?
Maybe it took his
job. You don't
job.
Have legs.
I don't know. I don't think
That's really harsh. I'm sorry. I don't mean to belittle this.
That's why I didn't bring it up. But it's, you know, I mean, these things.
I guess I just belittled someone's death, didn't I? God,
these things are bound to happen, you know. I mean, a robot, a big machine, it's going to.
So that when was that accident?
That was 1979 in Flat Rock, Michigan, January 25th. So it was almost like an anniversary.
So it was an early use of
okay, 79. Okay, I was about to say, the first one just happened? Really? We've gone that long without anyone ever having an industrial accident?
This is the first recorded one. Right. I don't know of any others, actually.
It's interesting. I wonder what kind of things they've engaged in those arms to make sure that doesn't happen. I guess one thing is don't get near them because everybody's seen those things move around and weld.
Oh,
they go really fast.
You don't want to be anywhere near one of these things.
But I bet there's also safety precautions of sensors. You know, if something's in its way, I bet it stops now. I bet there's like a lot more feedback systems.
There's so many things now. I mean, did you ever see that table saw?
Right. Where you could have one at work.
Really?
At UCSC, yeah.
Where you could have a, I mean, they haven't actually tested it with a finger, but like when you're sawing something, they put like a hot dog on there, which is kind of like a finger.
Those, yeah.
And as soon as the blade touches the hot dog, it immediately locks,
right?
And it just because of the, some kind of
what it's doing is it's detecting electrical discharge on the blade. Or the capacitance level on the blade changes very quickly. And as soon as that happens, it actually fires explosive charges like airbag charges.
Wow.
And fires this clamp that grabs the blade. It destroys the blade and it destroys the clamp. Got to buy a new one. Uh-huh. And there's one up at UCSC in the theater department lab. My friend Joe, who drove for the parade
for us. Oh, right,
yeah. Yeah, he got that. And he was like, you know, it's expensive to invest in it because, of course, it's a custom system.
Right.
And then every time the blade gets tripped, it's, you know, 200, 300, I can't remember how much it is, but it's an amount to get the system. But he's like, and I was like, well, have you had it trip? He's like, he's had it trip like three times.
Wow.
And they've all been not because the student, not because somebody would have lost a finger.
Uh-huh.
I think no one's would have lost a finger yet. But he says it's still worth it because one day it will save someone's finger.
I wonder if there's a study that says departments that have these saws have personnel with more fingers than departments that don't have these saws.
I'm sure that company will bring that study up someplace to sell more of these saw blades. I can't remember what it's called. Okay, well, that is we just had a really fun off-the-cuff thing.
Yep.
Normally, all of our stories are researched for 4 or 5 hours apiece.
Oh, yeah.
And so deviate from that and still sound like we know what we're doing is incredible.
Yep.
First actual planned story, Mr. Elam?
First actual planned story? Well, perhaps I could talk about...
Perhaps you could plan one.
You know what? I'm going to talk about Comcast.
Excellent.
We've talked in the past about some of the bad parts about Comcast, but they're doing something now that I think is very interesting and something that more ISPs should be doing, which is they are starting IP version 6 trials. And you can find out about this at comcast6.net.
That is cool.
And so if you are someone who knows what IP version 6 is, you're already ahead of the curve, and you want to try it out.
And you have
because
Comcast.
A lot of the hardware now supports it. If you've bought any of the home routers, and
I have Comcast.
Actually, I don't know. Do the home routers?
We need to
work
explain what it is, because people are like, "What the heck are you talking about?"
Okay, IP version 4 is what we use right now. That is the
Internet
set of numbers,
protocol.
Right? That is the set of numbers. Sometimes when you go to a browser, sometimes it's not a domain name; it's just a series of 4 numbers, and those were really useful 30 years ago when the internet was first being designed.
It was
and here's an example of those numbers. If you do what's called a ping on a domain like yahoo.com, which I just did, you get back an IP address and the internet protocol address, and it's an internet protocol address version 4, and it's 209.131.36.159. That's a specific number that is designated to a machine. In this case, it's probably designated to a front-end system that then distributes it. But for GeekSpeak, for example, we have one IP address.
Right.
That we use.
It's a 32-bit number, which means 2 to the 32, sounds like a large number.
That's a lot
of
numbers.
And it was when they were first making the protocol. It just so happens that that number is about a little more than 4 billion. And a bunch of them are used for overhead, like for things like you have your private network. If you have a home router, you have like 192.168.0.1 that isn't ever used on the public internet. So you take away some of that address space. Well, think about this for a moment. Think of everything that you have that's an IP address, which is your laptop, your cell phone if you have a smartphone, and most people have more than one computer in their home. Now think of the billions of people that are on the planet that are getting on there. It's estimated that 2 billion people out of the 6 or 7 billion on the planet have a computer. And so you can see that crunch is happening. Not to mention all the servers. Like Google has so many servers. Facebook has hundreds of thousands of servers. And
here's an example right now. Like you said, that there's some that's used for overhead. I just did a trace route, which is basically saying, hey, how does my information go from me to Yahoo, for example, that same IP address that I used? And it goes through 9 hops before it actually gets to Yahoo, which means 9 different IP addresses on the way just to get there. The first one is my local machine, which isn't actually a public IP address. The next one is looks like a Cruise.io IP address because KOSP gets its network from Cruise.io, the ISP, and it goes on from there going through the internet, the traffic, and that's how data gets sent via these numbers. So, yeah, there's a lot of overhead.
Right. So one thing that Internet version IP version 6 does is it expands the address space out to 128 bits. So 2 to the 128. And you think like, okay, 32 to 128, that must be four times as much. No. This is on the order of, you could give a few thousand, a few million, I forget what the stat was, IP addresses to each grain of sand on this planet with IP version 6.
Okay.
Wow. Which means instead of just doing just barely enough to handle what we have now or for the foreseeable future, you go that much further and say, let's be done for a while. We'll colonize Mars and still have it work.
Let's have IP for the solar system, please.
Right.
So then say you get the IP6 version of Comcast. What does that mean to me, the consumer?
What it means for you, how does it change? What it means right now is not, you're not going to really expand your experience. You're not going to see many websites that are going to do something that you couldn't possibly do with IP version 4. It does open up flexibility for voice over IP and IP telephony. It makes some things easier. It adds in IP security as part of the protocol. So it has some security aspects that are there. Routing becomes easier. But really what you're doing if you sign on for this trial is that you are going to be making it easier for all the folks that don't know how IP version 6 works. And you're also pushing the envelope and you're showing ISPs, not just Comcast, but ISPs in general, that there is interest, that there is a need to go there.
And, you know, at some point, this will be an absolute necessity to switch over. We will be in a situation where the systems will break.
But ultimately, you won't notice anything if you do this.
No, kind of like you won't notice anything if you recycle at home.
Right. Okay.
Well, what we will see is we won't necessarily run out of space and then, oh, no, we can't do anymore. What you're going to start seeing is auctioning off of address space.
Right.
Which means that getting a static IP address will become more and more expensive unless you move over to IPv6.
All right. So let's go on to the next story. Al, we've been trying to do this story for a long time because it's too great. So tell us about Pong Prom.
It's this weird application I ran across. It's actually an art project. And it says that it comes from the Department of Covert Athletics, which is just covertathletics.com. And it's like a game called Pong Prom. And what it does is you wear this thing like it's a sweatshirt, like a hoodie, and it's got these sensors in it. And on your chest, you have a LCD readout. And so you wear one of these hoodies. And then you give the other one to presumably your partner. And then you put your hands on the shoulder of your partner or
like
the,
a dance
the waist.
Position.
Yeah, a dance position. And then you start the game and it's got an accelerometer in it. And you're actually playing Pong on each. You're looking at each other's chest.
Uh-huh.
And you're playing Pong by moving.
Now, Pong is that traditional video game where you've got a screen and two paddles, one on each side, and a ball bounces back and forth.
Right.
And you try to bounce the ball back with your paddle.
Yeah.
And so in this situation, all you see is, I'm assuming, your paddle and their screen. On their screen, you see your paddle and a Pong thing. And as you move back and forth, your paddle on their shirt moves.
Right.
So you both do this. It looks like a crazy dance.
Yeah. The patches of conductive fabric. They're on the shoulders, hips, and cuffs. So that allows for serial communication between microcontrollers attached to each shirt.
That's great.
And, you know, they have a little video of this. And when you watch it, you know, it's actually kind of cool looking.
Are they using Adreno boards, did it say?
Doesn't say that. It says the lily pad Adreno platform.
Yeah, cool.
Yeah. So they are. Yeah, that's controlling the gameplay.
Adreno is a microcontroller on a USB programmable microcontroller. And the lily pad version of it is specifically designed to be attached to clothing. So you can sew it onto clothes and wash it and everything.
That's exactly what they're doing. And the accelerometer apparently is attached to the back of the neck.
You could technically just move the back of your head kind of there.
I guess it's hard to move the top of your spine kind of dancing.
But how still can you be?
But it's kind of neat. You know, it's got these two people dancing and it looks really neat. It's an art project.
Since you brought up digital art, I'll talk about an art show. But I don't know if it's actually an art show. It's called Fun a Day. And it's a you do something fun that you like to do every day of the month of January. And then at the end of that, you post all your content into – it gets put in the gallery. So I've had friends that have done, an oil painting every day, or charcoal painting every day, or a photograph every day, or a song every day. And this year, I decided to go ahead and do a program every day, an application every day. And I've been making these little Java applets with a thing called processing. And they're not all of them. Some of them are fun. Some of them are rushed. But I had a good time programming every day. I've got one more to do. Because today's two more to do.
Yeah, you were showing me those. Were kind of cool.
I don't always have them posted on my website, but some of them are. If you want to take a look, you've got to have Java enabled on your machine, but you probably do. That's at lyle.troxel.com, and I'll put it on the show page at geekspeak.org as well. Okay, anyway, moving on to Mr. Elam's next story. And Miles, I'm going to ask you about Chromium. Not the element.
Right.
Okay.
Google has a browser called Chrome. It's gotten a lot of press.
It's quite good.
And it's quite good. They have a version that's open source. That isn't Google branded. It's simply the code base they're working from, and they call that Chromium. They've taken the step of actually putting out a reward for people finding security bugs. If you can find a security bug in the Chromium source code, Google will pay you $500.
Woohoo!
If you find something that's multiple bugs, they'll pay you, multiples of $500. If it's a particularly severe or particularly clever bug, you'd be eligible for a $1,337.
You say
reward.
You'd be eligible?
You would be.
Okay.
Eligible.
For more money, how much? 1,024?
1,337, which is leet. 1337.
Gotcha. Thank you.
In leet speak.
Leet speak is a way of...
They don't really need to know.
Okay.
It's better if it dies.
Al, you asked a while ago what this meant on my laptop.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, that's actually leet speak for geek.
Oh, I see.
Anyway, moving on, but more to your story. The Chrome browser, therefore, the base level is open source, but when Google releases it, they do some stuff to it?
They put branding onto it.
But that's pretty much it?
And then, this is the case with many people that use an open source base. Like, for example, Apple. Apple has the browser base is called WebKit.
And that's inside Safari.
Right. And then they put a shell around it and put, the Apple logo and Apple information. And they may include other things like, for example, the H.264 codec, things that are proprietary that they have licensing deals with others that you can't put into an open source program, but then some company can put in. So Google can make some deals and put in, for example, support for H.264.
Which is a video codec, which...
Right, which you see on YouTube, is H.264.
Unless you're doing Flash.
No, with Flash, it's actually pulling an H.264.
Oh, really? Oh, cool.
That's what I thought.
I'm not sure. I think they have multiple versions, because some versions of YouTube videos you can't actually play on your iPhone, and I'm assuming that's because there isn't a version of codec that's H.264. So,
good
no,
point.
It's not for everything. But in any case, this is not something you can do with a closed system.
Or
you can't say to the public, hey, anybody, if you see any problems here, please help us. You know what? We'll pay you if you help us.
Yeah, and that's a whole long argument about the pros and cons about it, which we won't get into. But
we won't. But one of the things you've said in the past, and this is a good example of it, is voting machines. A perfect example of when you should have complete transparency on how the system works so that this can happen, for example. Anybody can look at it and go, wait, this is a problem here.
Mm-hmm.
And that can't be done in a closed system, but it can be done in an open system. Anyway.
So we can do it with browsers, and we can do it with slot machines. But apparently voting machines are off limits for trying to make better and more secure.
And in Internet Explorer, we talk about quite a bit as it has a lot of bugs in it. And one of the things that's going on is that it's not because people know the source code and they're able to look through it, like in this case Google does with their browser. It's because when a problem emerges, a very smart programmer, hacker, says, you know what? There might be a way I can take advantage of this to see if I can run code. And that question, that inkling, that desire to discover, which is hacking, leads them to try to discover how to do it. And then if they can exploit it, that's when we hear about these exploits. That's what it really is. Someone found a problem, then looked at it, investigated, figured out how to do it, and said, hey, you know what? There's a problem here. And then when Microsoft gets around to it, months and months later, sometimes they finally fix it.
Well, Microsoft and others. Microsoft's not the only one.
True,
This has happened to the Mozilla Foundation. It's happened to Google themselves. So.
All right. Al.
Yes?
Hi. How's it going?
Good.
I have been making sure I'm doing my best not to let food spoil in my fridge, which has been difficult when we have these power outages for a couple days. So a couple days of power outage, I have something in the fridge. Is it good or not?
Right. Well, if you are in that situation, you may want to check out stilltasty.com. I ran across this website, and of course, they also have an iPhone app. I noticed everybody, you know, iPhone apps seem to be, you know, companions to these websites now. But you can type in, you know, any kind of food, just about any kind of food, and then hit search, and it'll tell you how long this food is supposed to be able to last in your refrigerator. So say I go to this the website and I type in the word chicken, and then it's got all these different kinds of what kind of chicken, homemade, unopened chicken breast. But let's just say fresh, raw chicken breasts.
Okay, fresh, raw chicken breasts.
Yeah, in the refrigerator, it will last 1 to 2 days, and in the freezer, it will last 9 months. Has a nice little chart here. So all these things that you put in there, you know, even if you put in something like, say, pizza. So if I type in pizza and then I hit search, it'll say commercially or frozen, homemade or takeout. So I say takeout, you know, so I went out and bought pizza and I didn't finish. And I put it in the refrigerator. How long can it stay in there? 3 to 4 days. All right. People out there are going, okay, what? 3 to 4 days?
How about sushi?
Sushi. Yeah. Let's see.
3 or 4 days. That's it?
Yeah. That's what we're all saying because we leave it in there a long time. But, you know, let's see. Sushi, fresh, raw sushi, 1 day.
One? That's it?
It says, if you have it in the refrigerator, 1 day. It says it does not freeze well. So you should keep refrigerated in a covered container. It's a very simple UI here. It's just one search thing. It's, you know, like Google, it's colorful. It's got the right kind of food colors, orange and kind of reddish.
Right.
So it looks very foodie and free, and you can just type in if you're ever wondering, you know, let's see, this has been in the refrigerator for how long?
For too long.
Yeah, can I eat it now? But it's I think it's a good reference.
All right. Well, thank you very much for the update on whether food is okay in your
yeah. It's still tasty.com.
But of course, it doesn't really help us that much when the power goes out. We don't know how long it still is tasty.
That's true.
Yeah. I guess you taste it and find out.
Yeah, get a generator.
Geek Speak on. Hey, a couple weeks ago when the power was coming, going to go down because of the storms, you said I got my generator already. Did everything go okay?
Yeah, it ran great. And although you know the technology of gas cans has just really been flat for the past, you know, 50 years.
I agree
because they keep coming out with these new contraptions to try to make the gas can easy to pour out and stuff. But almost every single time, I've gotten gas all over myself.
Yes.
I get it all over myself.
I had the same experience last night. I was working on a chainsaw, and exactly.
How hard can it be to just design
a good valve?
A good valve that you just press a button.
And it opens up and pours out. You know, I feel every time something like that happens, and I look at all this technology in the world that's so good, and then you look at that, and you go, what the heck? There's some regulation. There's some rule somewhere in someone's legal documents that say you have to do these things, and those things make it so that it isn't very good.
Yeah.
I'm assuming it's legislation.
I think just going to end up smelling like gas.
I smell like gas right now.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Geek Speak on KOSP is supported by Henry J. Ramirez, DDS in Santa Cruz, specializing in cosmetic and family dentistry. Using digital technology for less radiation, offering one appointment crowns and veneers. For appointments and more information, 423-2447. You can call us as well today. Rick is back, and the phone number is to call us and ask us anything you'd like. Anything you'd like, please do so. The phone numbers are 476-2800. Again, that's 476-2800. Or you can call us toll-free, 1-800-655-5877. Again, that toll-free number is 1-800-655-KUSP. And it's KUSP because you're listening to KUSP, Central Coast Public Radio KUSP. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me, we have Miles Elam and Al Luckow. And we're taking your calls with questions and comments of technology. If you didn't get those phone numbers, I'm going to give them to you in just a second. Just one more second, I'll give them to you. Well, I'm exaggerating. Maybe 2 minutes. Geek Speak on KOSP is supported by the University of Advancing Technology, offering master's degree programs for geeks to become innovators of the future. Classes now forming for January. uat.edu/masters. We normally do podcast of the week or iPhone app of the week, but this time it's a whole podcast service kind of thing that, Miles, you were telling me about this morning.
Yes, iTunes U, a nice little Apple plug there, except it's absolutely free.
So and if you have iTunes, you can find iTunes
right.
U.
And the content that I was most interested in is something that I've been a personal interest of mine, which is going back and getting better at calculus. I took it years ago and have since forgotten it and wanted to look it up. And you can look up, for example, for me, it was MIT lectures of single variable calculus. All of them video and audio, relatively high quality, and absolutely free.
Wow.
And this, and it's not just limited to mathematics, you know, subjects like that. You have, you know, physics and the like, but you also have economics, and I believe I saw some arts courses on there as well. But if you're ever, you know, strapped for time for taking a class, you don't want to go to a fixed schedule, or if you're just one of those self-starters that you don't need the class, you just want to get the information, go through it, this is the way to go. I highly recommend it.
Thank you very much. iTunes U. So are you going to start doing calculus again?
I have started listening to them or watching them.
I'm going to have to do it too. I'll find some free time.
It's kind of tough because I've already taken it. So there's a lot of things right now I'm like, okay, I already know this, but I don't want to skip over to go to the next chapter
because
he may come across something that I don't know.
Did you buy the book too?
I actually already have two calculus. Oh, I only have one calculus book now because I gave one to you.
You destroyed a book. my first iPod was given to me by Miles for my birthday, and what he did is he cut out the shape of the iPod box out of a calculus book and then gave me a calculus book. I'm all, oh, cool, thanks, a calculus book. Now, for geeks, you have to understand that actually getting a calculus book is not actually a bad gift. Like, it was okay. I already had one, so I was like, but it's a different version, so, you know, who knows.
And
so
then I said, turn to page 100, turn to page 86.
So I think he's going to give me a free lesson on calculus. So I open it up, I'm like, oh, sweet iPod, thanks.
Right, and he's like, yes. Everybody's like, what, is there a card in there?
Wait,
like,
so now with iTunes
you never know what you're going to get out of calculus. He pulls out an iPod from his book.
And the thing is, it's really interesting, is that iPod I could use to listen to the class on, actually, yeah. Anyway.
Yeah, assuming I hadn't cut out the center of that book, so all the lessons and graphs were all torn up.
Someone came up to me yesterday at work and said, I need to cut out a book. Can I do that with the laser cutter? I'm like, yes. It'd be a lot easier than cutting out by hand because, of course...
That was hard.
That was hard to cut out a book by hand. I want to let you know that I've lost my place on what I was doing. How's that for an answer? GeekSpeak is a Creative Commons license show. That means that you can use it if you don't use it for commercial purposes. So, attribution, non-commercial, share alike, 3.0. United States license. That means you can use it for non-commercial purposes as long as you attribute to us, and you don't have to ask us anything else. It's just that when you make work, or when you do make work with it, you've got to attribute to us, and you also have to also use the license. You have to share your work. So that's it. It's Creative Commons. And the theme song today, and I feel like a jerk because I don't have this in front of me easily. There it is. The theme song was by Newman, Michael Newman. Pet Star Music made our theme song, and it is also Creative Commons, and thank you very much, Newman. You can find out about his site from our website, of course. Moving on to the content of the week. More news, or should we take calls? Oh, gosh, I think we should take calls. Miles, you okay with that?
I'm fine.
All right, let's do that then. From New York City, Brian, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hey, fellas. I got a question for you. You're probably bored with the subject already, but I can't hear the show. I can't stream it here at work. Wow. So I'm just a podcast listener, a week behind. So you may have already touched on this subject today, but I was interested in the iPad. I was thinking about getting one of the e-reader Kindle type devices. You know, I know a fella that has one. I see people with them on the subway, and and I thought, well, a few hundred extra bucks, you know, I could get this thing and it can do more.
Not even a few hundred.
I was a little disappointed that it was so big, because it makes it a little awkward just to kind of pull out of your bag or whatever while you're commuting and stuff. But I'm looking at the thing and I was thinking, well, how would you? Other than reading or maybe watching video, if you're navigating a web page, or in particular if you're typing, I mean, the ergonomics of it, I was just thinking that you're going to be doing a one-hand typing. I mean, if you're holding it like a clipboard, I guess if you're sitting, you could prop it up on your knees, something. But it looked to me like, well, let's pretty awkward for two-handed typing on the thing.
Yeah, well, let's talk about that. We'll run with that. The iPad is Apple's new product. It's a very large iPhone, basically, without ability to make a phone call.
Or take photos.
Or find out your location with GPS. I don't think it has GPS in it, but I'm not sure. So the question, of course, and it has – the iPhone has a virtual keyboard. Whenever you need to type, you can use your thumbs. And the thing that's nice about the thumb use, of course, is just like any cell phone, you can use your thumbs pretty effectively and still hold it. And you can even use one thumb because it can reach across the entire keyboard because it's pretty small. It fits in the palm of your hand. On the iPad, of course, the same type of keypad exists, but you can't really use one thumb on it. Totally true, because it goes across the whole screen, and the screen is a diagonal of 9 inches, I think.
It's 9.7-inch LED backlit. Right.
Okay. And that's the diagonal, so it's like 7 inches by 9.5 inches, or 7 inches by 6 inches. I don't know.
Well, anyway. There's been a lot of talk about the iPad, and yeah. I think we'll just leave the name alone for the moment.
Yeah,
because But the thing about it is, if you talk to people who have iPhones, just about universally, everybody loves it.
Yeah.
And the iPhone, the Apple put a lot of research into the UI on the iPhone. A lot of things they made to be intuitive. So when they came out with the iPad, you know, they didn't come out with something that's completely different, because that's silly. The one thing Apple is really good at is consistency. And that's why when you pick up an Apple product, you can immediately know how to use it without looking at a manual. So when people saw this, they said, well, it looks like the iPhone, but that's the whole point, is that you could take this iPad and just immediately be using it without having to look at any kind of instructions, because it's already been designed. They've already figured out a lot of these issues. They're not going to do something completely different so that you have to learn a whole new UI.
Right. That being said, a split keyboard that meshed in the lower left-hand and right-hand corner so your mm-hmm. thumbs could use it mm-hmm. would be a better way to do a keyboard when you're holding it. Because it's very true. It's going to be hard to hold. You're going to have to hold the whole thing with one hand. Therefore, anytime you type, you're going to have to use a lot of tension
Do a lot of typing on it.
And the other thing is, they do have keyboard dock, and it supports Bluetooth full standard. So you can get a Bluetooth keyboard.
You could get a keyboard,
which is really nice.
And the thing
you can't do that on an iPhone.
But we're drifting here.
Yes,
he's talking about
ergonomics.
Should he get that over a Kindle
to some degree,
or something like that?
But you're looking at a very similar price point. And if you look at a Kindle, we can talk about typing on a Kindle. I mean,
well,
this thing
it's small enough where your thumbs can reach across. I'm not sure mm-hmm. if the iPad is small enough to thumbs reach across.
Their size dimensions are actually fairly similar.
Okay, all right.
Yeah, it looks. Pretty good.
Yeah.
Also, the thing about it's in color. It plays movies.
Yeah, if you're going to go between a Kindle and an iPad, of course the iPad, except that it's first technology.
Well, you know, you're going to be bleeding edge if you get the first one of anything.
Yeah.
And if you get it, if you're looking at the two things, basically the Kindle, you get a lot of battery life. It goes like a month or something, because it's just black and white, and it's
right.
sort of passive. The iPad is going to be 10 hours.
Yeah, after 10 hours of usage.
If you're using it. And it's about the size of a book, and you can...
And that 10 hours is general use. They haven't released the video time playing hours
right.
yet.
So, and it's
less for
video. It's the thickness of a magazine.
Half an inch.
It would be like a Cosmopolitan, I guess.
Yeah, which is not too different from the Kindle.
Right.
So the dimensions are about the same as the Kindle. So
right.
if size is an issue, it's really not if you're talking about those two devices.
The other thing that I just wanted to say about the iPad is that if you look at Apple historically about how products come out from Apple, mm-hmm. you'll see a product come out like the iMac, and then you'll see the MacBook. Okay? You always see like... a sort of an entry-level product, and then right after it, you see another product
right.
that is like, wow, you know.
So are you hoping that the iPad's going to, there's going to be a newer version that's even better?
Well, my thought is that they're probably, I'm just saying historically, Apple does this 1-2 punch thing, and I can also tell you that the people who buy iMacs are usually very happy with them. So the entry-level products are usually less expensive, and a lot of people go for that simply because they want all these cool things. But if you're one of those people that really is like, I need to have every single thing in the world, mm-hmm. then I think it might be worth looking at for a few more months, because, you know, that's historically they do this 1-2 punch. You know, there's the iPod.
But isn't that
and then
a year later?
Yeah,
well,
not to mention the fact that they've announced the dates on these. Like, it's going to be another 2 months before you can even
right.
buy one, and that's the Wi-Fi only. And then you have to wait, what, another 3 months?
90 days, yeah. So full 90 days to get the one with the cell phone service.
So, I mean,
G3 service for network.
Yeah. Right.
Brian, did we kind of talk about what you want to talk about?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I accept the fact that if I got the Kindle, that's pretty much I'd just be using it for an e-book. My whole point was, like, why not spend a little more or consider spending a little more and have this other functionality. But then when I saw it, you know, as far as for my purposes, like using it commuting and stuff, I just thought, you know, it would be really hard to use other than just reading or viewing video, anything that required typing or anything like that. I started to have visions of, you know, the first laptop, some guy walking in a lab and showing it to the finance people who finance the thing, and they, well, how do you type on it? And maybe the technician says, well, I got an idea. Why don't we cut it in half and put a hinge on it?
Right.
You know, I mean, it seems like, I don't know.
I think the answer to long-term typing on that thing will be to dock it with a keyboard, to use a keyboard. If I get one, I'll definitely be using a keyboard to type, because you can really mess up your hands
or
by doing the same things all the time.
The other thing is, you know, Apple doesn't usually just make arbitrary decisions. None of us here have really picked one up and tried it.
Right.
That's the thing. The iPhone, there was a lot of criticism about the touchpad, and everybody said, oh, that's terrible. You'll never be able to do that. But then when you actually did it, everybody realized this actually works, and then every single company in the world tries to copy it. So the proof is going to be when you actually are able to pick one up and want to go to one of the Apple stores and try it out, and then you either decide for yourself whether it works or not. Because
exactly. That's why I was asking you guys. I thought, yeah, I may be overlooking the obvious, and I'm sure that's what I thought. They must have thought this thing through. I'm right here by the flagship Apple store in New York City, and I figure at some point I'm going to be able to see someone in there using it like I'm talking about, besides just having it laying on a counter and leaned over it.
But. Yeah, and really the thing that concerns me is that because the key, it's a full-size keyboard almost, right? It's like a small keyboard that you can get all your fingers on at the same time. I'm fearful that people are going to lay it flat on the table or stand it up slightly. And if you lean it up slightly and then start typing, you're really hyperextending your fingers. You know, your arms are going to be bent backwards, and that's really not the right way to do it. You really should have your keyboard kind of lean forwards. So to lean that forward, you won't be able to see the screen very well. So that...
You can turn it sideways, right?
And even if you just serve it sideways, the surface you view, you want to have angled towards your eyes, and the surface you type on, you want to be angled away from your hands.
Yeah.
So it is problematic.
That's what the keyboard
would be for.
It would be an awesome device, though. I mean,
you want one.
Even if it just does.
You're going to get one, and your kids are going to take it away from you, I can tell.
It's, you know.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Brian, for the call.
Yeah.
Take care.
Thanks a lot, guys.
Bye-bye. And from Dallas, Texas, Jordan, welcome to Geek Speak.
Howdy.
Howdy, Jordan. Hi.
Howdy.
What's your question?
I got this iPod, and it's one of the newest ones, and they're a genius, and it just fucking won't work. I don't know why.
Okay, please don't swear again, okay?
I'm sorry.
Okay, we're going to have to take you out. Sorry. So the iPod Nano... not syncing because it's not Genius not working on it. So what I would go with is doing Genius on the computer that you dock with. So you sync the iPod up to the computer and do Genius on there.
On iTunes.
Mm-hmm. And Genius is this kind of algorithm thing where you have to send all this information about your music to Apple, so they can kind of make a profile about the music you're listening to. And once they make a profile, they look at all your songs, they see other people that have made playlists, and then they assign other songs in your collection that are related to each other.
And you have to activate Genius.
And you have to activate it.
And if you don't activate it, it's not going to work.
So a lot of syncing is required, and you've got to use iTunes. And then you should have that information sync over to the iPod. I'm not sure what the problem is when this is going on, but we can't really continue that call because there's some inappropriate language. So sorry about that. All right, so let's move on to Aptos. Terry, welcome to Geek Speak. Hi, Terry. What's your question today?
I have a question about recycling old computers that won't reboot, and therefore I can't get the private information off of them.
Ah, so safely removing your information before... Is this a desktop or a laptop?
Two laptops.
Oh.
Yes.
Take the drive out.
Well, yeah, but it's a laptop.
Well...
And, I mean, if you want to recycle it and you don't care if it's reused or not, then, yeah, you can just...
take out all the screws, pull out the laptop.
It's fun. It's fun to take apart a
smack with a hammer.
If you're not worried about it breaking it or anything.
I guess that's true.
We like it. I'll take it apart. Yeah.
Give it to an 8-year-old with a screwdriver and you're set.
Right.
You might have to have a torque wrench and an Allen wrench as well, but and different sizes. I think
not,
that's
not if you don't care about if you If you don't care about putting it back together again, you can absolutely
I would agree, except that I think that most of the recycling venues, you kind of have to show that it's a computer source. Not just a pile of plastic and metal. So, and you don't really want to trash it completely because it's going to be harder for them to pull the components out and you know, reuse the material to actually recycle. I think, do you have banking information on that hard drive?
Well, that's what we don't remember. It probably is credit cards.
I think the only safe thing is to take the hard drive out.
Okay, I got a safe one. It's great.
All right.
Genius. Okay. You got to know where your hard drive is in the laptop, and all you have to do is drill through it.
Oh.
So if you're...
Wait, unless you wanted to have it intact.
Well, if the machine's not going to be reused, it's just going to be recycled, it won't matter if there's a drill hole through it. They will still recycle it.
Okay.
But if somebody wants to reuse it, then... find someone to reuse it. The other thing to do is this, and actually this is probably a pretty good idea. If the machine would actually work and it's not that old and you think that somebody might actually refurbish it to make it work again, like Gray Bears in this area is really great. You're in Aptos, right? Yeah, Gray Bears is great.
Oh.
You call them up. Call up Gray Bears and say, look, I've got these laptops. I'd like to recycle them or reuse them, let you guys reuse them, but I'm really concerned about my secure data. Is there any assurance that you will destroy those hard drives or completely wipe them for me? And if not, I'm going to have to drill through it or hit it with a sledgehammer and take it to the dump. And I bet they will say, yeah, if you bring it in, this is our policy. Because this is such a common issue. They don't want to be the transmitter of private data, right? They want to help people reuse computers and reuse technology and allow lots of people to use computers. That's kind of a mission of theirs, right? So to be in a situation where they think that people that donate information to them, that information could be reused, they don't want that to happen. So I bet they have a good policy on this. And I would contact Gray Bears.
And is it possible if a laptop is 5 years old, could it be reused?
Yeah,
sure. Yeah, I was talking just last week about how I reused the iMacs, which are...
But those were desktops.
Yeah, they were desktops.
Laptops are really great, and this is why...
Wait, PowerBook G4s, they're 5 years old, aren't they?
At least.
I'm using one right now.
Miles has one.
A five-year-old laptop.
He's got one older than you're getting rid of.
Even older
it's
than
older
that.
Than that.
Yeah.
But the thing that's great about yours is that there's like glue holding the hinge together. And it's like, you've got like paper clips holding the frame.
Yeah.
Are there any keys missing?
No.
Wow, I'm impressed.
It runs on coal, though. It's very smoky in the air room right now.
So, an old laptop. Here's a great reason for an old laptop. If you're listening to a lot of MP3s and a lot of music that's stored on hard drives, a laptop is a wonderful way to do this because it has low power consumption. So you don't want to run a really heavy, expensive desktop all the time because that uses a lot of energy. And additionally, if you leave a computer running all the time and when the power does go out, you can actually damage the machine. Well, with a laptop, when the power goes out, it stops charging, but it has a battery, so it's going to be okay.
As long as you're on a surge protector.
Yeah.
It has a fuse.
Yeah. So using a laptop for like your home always-on computer is great use for it. And if you reinstall, what I would do on an old laptop, if you've got an old laptop, you want to reuse it, is I would go grab an Ubuntu and install Ubuntu on it. Fresh, because it's going to be relatively clean and be able to do what you need to do on it, Miles.
I just realized it's another way to get rid of all your data on there. Get a bulk eraser, like the type they use for videotaping.
I don't think that
like.
Works on a hard drive.
Really?
I don't think so.
I would be worried about it, too.
And if it won't boot, still something can be done?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. If your machine can't boot, most likely it's just the hard drive, actually.
Yeah.
It's just the operating system. You probably just replace the hard drive or reinstall the operating system and you'd probably be okay.
Oh, okay.
But that depends. I mean, it could be a power supply.
What kind of laptops are they?
Both are HPs.
Hmm. From Hewlett-Packard?
Yes.
Okay. Good luck.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
You know, I forgot to mention, I want to mention this earlier in the show, just like Newman made a theme song, we're getting different theme songs all the time. If you've got an inkling to be creative for Geek Speak, we'd love your creativity, and we will take advantage of you till the cows come home. We love theme songs. Please submit them to us. What you can do is just upload them to some service and send us the URL. We'll all listen to it. If we like it, we'll put it on air. And the other thing we need every single week is an image, a 400 pixel by 400 pixel image for the show. So today, if something motivated you and you're an artist that can do digital work of some form, go ahead and make us an image for the today's show. We like it. We'll use it for the show. And this would be a great challenge for you every week if you listen to us live to get on the computer at the beginning of the show, listen to our news in the beginning, try to make some kind of collaboration of what we talk about and throw it on the website. And then send us the link and we'll throw it up on the website.
The dimensions for that image again are?
400 pixels by 400 pixels. I mean, 640 by 640 is fine. It needs to be square. It needs to be bigger than 300 pixels by 300 pixels. And you can email it to me, Lyle@geekspeak.org, if you so choose to do so. All right. Okay, so we've lost a couple calls, unfortunately, because we took so much time. So Bill called in. He's not on the phone anymore, but he recommends pulling hard drives out of machines before recycling the machine, which is totally the way to do it.
Yeah, this actually brought to mind the issue of encryption, hard drive encryption. It's a pain in the it's a pain because every time you boot up, you'd have to put in a passphrase,
yeah.
And you can't ever forget that passphrase.
Yes.
But if you have an encrypted hard drive, it means that once you're done with it, you're pretty safe to hand it over.
That's true.
That even if something's unexpected, it gets stolen, it's all encrypted, someone else might as well just overwrite it because they can't read it.
Oh, okay. So Bill Mensch actually called in, the person that called in. He's in Santa Cruz. And he recycles PCs. He'll take out the drives and assure your data is safe. And his number is 425-8740. Again, that's 425-8740 is Bill Mensch. And we'll put that up on the website as well, geekspeak.org. And then Cynthia in Santa Cruz recommends Gray Bears. And we lost Michael. Why can't I download photos to an iPod? The only way to get photos on the iPod is to use iPhoto. And you've got to put the photos into iPhoto and then in iTunes, say over in the Photos tab that you need to sync the photos back. And it is kind of a pain. We've had trouble with this.
Unless you're on Windows. In which case
you can't, right?
No, it looks in the My Photos directory. Or My Pictures. Sorry.
My Pictures directory. So you put photos in My Pictures. Yeah. My Pictures inside of My Documents.
Yeah. Although you can have it pointed to another application. I forget which one it is. But yes, it can be done on Windows as well.
All right. Miles, I think you handled all your news stories. But Al, you've still got lots of tasty news stories. So,
why don't I talk about the GetJar?
Yeah, that sounds good.
Last week I talked about a web page called App A Day, and it was a way that you could, you know, they featured a different iPhone app every single day, but, you know, there's lots of smartphones, not just the iPhone. There's all sorts of smartphones. Well, there's this other website called GetJar, getjar.com, and this website, when you first go there, it'll pop up with a window. It says, what's your mobile phone manufacturer and model? You type it in. And it will show you all the apps, or hundreds, thousands probably, of apps that are available for your phone with individual reviews and links on how to get them and all that kind of stuff. So it's almost like an alternative to the Apple store, but it encompasses all, including the iPhone, it encompasses all different kinds of smartphones. And I think those people out there that have all the other different kinds of phones might want to try this website out. It really seems quite comprehensive to me, and it's very well done. It's called getjar.com. Great. I guess jar, isn't that a type of compression? Or I'm not sure why they call
it
jar.
It's commonly used with Java. It's Java Archive. That's what it stands for. It's a way of taking all the little program components and putting it into a single file.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I don't know why they call it that.
Because that's the file that you distribute the games, the systems with,
oh,
the apps
that's
with.
What it is.
Yeah,
it's
most of those phones are probably going to be, I'm trying to think.
It'd be like saying get PDF.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, on the contrary, many of them are mobile edition of Java. They're J2ME.
Yeah.
So they would be Java apps, so of course they would be jars. So it sounds like that site is only doing Java-based apps.
Well, yeah, but most...
No, there are all different kinds of apps. I mean, I even looked one up for the iPhone and found it, and it was really cool. It's called Wi-Fi Fo-Fum.
Oh. But you can't install it from there. You've got
to... It sent me to a link, and then I had to do the normal thing. But it's just another way of finding apps that's not the Apple-sanctioned
By all means,
way.
Support it, because those developers had to work really hard to get it on each and every phone.
No, what it is that in the beginning, you submit your app, you say which phones you support, and then when you go to the website as a user, you say, this is my phone, and it filters out all the apps that are available for your phone.
No, you're talking about from the consumer point of view. I'm talking about from the developer point of view.
I'm saying from the developer point of view, you make an app for one phone,
right,
and you submit it there, and so,
or maybe two, but
yeah exactly.
Like,
it's not
your
it's
app has like 400 different versions if you're trying to hit all the market. It's ridiculous.
All right.
I do have some quick news.
One thing quick.
Yes, data.gov, they've added a whole bunch of new information. So if you actually want to get the real skinny on stuff like Medicare and job rates and crime, stuff like that. Go to data.gov. It has some raw data. You can sift through it yourself without any spin.
How does data.gov deliver data? Is it tabbed limit files?
It depends. I'm assuming for the most part it is. But
we're in this really magical place right now, everybody, that a lot of information is available to you. You'd be surprised. I'll just leave it at that. Al, another quick mention before we do USB the
Week.
Well,
I remember I talked about the old computer that I rejuvenated for my kids. We left the station
last week,
and I said, "Hey, Lyle, can you wait in the car for a minute?" And I went into the Goodwill. Where was it? The Goodwill?
No, it's Abbott's Thrift in Felton.
And went in there and just looked, and they had boxes of old CD-ROMs
for G4 computers.
Yeah.
For OS 9.
Literally
like a stack. I hold in your hand.
Yeah, I had a huge pile of these things.
For like under 10 bucks.
Yeah, they were like 99 cents a piece.
And so they're educational games for kid ranges that fit.
Full blown CD-ROMs
that's a really good use for an old computer. You take an old computer, you set it up, make sure it works, don't give it internet access, go buy some cheap old games that are educational based and make sure that you think the content on them is appropriate for your kids. Mm-hmm. And you might need to take a look at the game before you decide.
Reuse, recycle.
In just a second, we're going to do Al's USB, crazy USB of the week. So stay tuned for that. GeekSpeak on KOSP is supported by Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence and is used with permission. We have to get David on the show. He keeps on saying he's going to be on the show, and I never set it up. I've got to get David Lawrence on the show. He's a total cool geek. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the Arum, we have Miles Elam. And, of course, we also have Al Luckow.
Hello, everybody. This is Al Luckow. I was just sitting around reminiscing about all these crazy USB devices I bring up every week. There have been a lot over the past year. And right about now, you're probably wondering, how am I going to plug all these things in? I mean, most computers only have 2, sometimes 3 USB ports, and most hubs usually only have 5. What if you want to plug in your USB lava lamp and use your USB endoscope while you're copying things off your USB shuriken flash drive onto USB hard drive while simultaneously downloading photos off your digital camera, syncing your iPod, talking on your webcam to your friend while enjoying the breeze from your USB fan with your USB eye warmers and your USB foot warmers on while breathing in the beautiful scents from your USB aromatherapy speaker and radio? Yeah. Well, I have the answer. It's the 80-port USB hub. Yes, 80 ports. I'd like to tell you more, but the whole webpage is in Japanese, so I'll just tell you the info I was able to get out of it. It's red, and it has 80 ports. Links up on geekspeak.org.
Every week, all the stuff we talk about, we put up on geekspeak.org. That's geekspeak.org as an organization. We're a nonprofit. Well, kind of. We volunteer. And KOSP, of course, is a nonprofit. And you can participate in helping KOSP anytime you'd like by contacting the station, by donating. Miles, do you have a follow-up on how Gov has given us info?
Yes. Data comes in XML, comma separated value, or text, KML, shapefile, and other formats. However, each individual data point may only show up in one format. So one thing may be in comma separated value, another thing may be in XML only.
You know, that's a lot of different data types, and that means it's a lot of work to get that data out.
I think managing the data is harder than dealing with the data types. I mean,
that's
XML,
like a whole career, data
comma
manager.
Separated value, they're all text. Parsers.
Is there a way to go through school and just become a data manager expert? I mean, because that's a job, and that's going to get harder and harder, and we're going to need more of those people. It's the new accountant. Wouldn't you agree? Well, we'll talk about it again next week, I'm sure. This is KOSP and GeekSpeak.